Monday morning. What I'd like to do this morning, quite frankly, I'm not sure we're going to get to SB 834, but I want to start with 3225. First of all, very briefly going through the dash fours, just because that's what we've agreed to pretty much previously. And then I'd like to talk about some of the other amendments, the dash 1002s. Gotta get that gelled up so that we can be ready to move a bill out tomorrow afternoon. I want everyone to understand just exactly what we've got, what we had presented to us over the weekend. The dash fours, as I said, are what we conceptually agreed to and asked you to put into a language form. The dash 1002s are the other concepts that have been floating around that we asked, Jeanette, that we asked Jeanette to get into some kind of a form so that you can take a look at those as well. So first of all, and I don't, hopefully we don't have to spend a whole lot of time on the dash 04s. Does anyone on the committee have any concerns they wanted to verbalize on those in that form? We'll have other amendments coming in. Jensen?
Section 1, 3, sub 3. Okay. 80 is in the state of Ohio, so I'm on it.
Like we're on the dash 4 amendment, page 1, line 16. Section 2, right. Representative Jensen is suggesting instead of wild, substitute native for still mounted population.
Any other suggestions?
I don't know. Do we want to go through just down through my issues? Section 5, 2AA. I understand, Mr. Chair, your position on dual confirmation, and I don't quarrel with that, but if we don't have dual confirmation, I would feel better if the member were elected by the board rather than being either the board chair or their designee, board or commission.
You're on line, which line are you on?
I don't have, well.
Yeah, I'm on line.
Yeah, I do have.
This one says, I'm on line 29 and 30, the chair of each of the following commissions, or a member of the board or commission designated by the commission. That would be elected by the commission. My apologies. And in B of that, 2B, it says that each, that'd be on line 9 and 10, page 8. I think it says each public member shall serve for a term of 4 years. And I could not find anywhere in here where there might be a reappointment or they might serve more than one term. And it may be here, but I couldn't find it, and I would, unless it's our intention that we term them out after 4 years, I think it might be better if we had something of that kind.
I think it's normal that they serve 2 terms.
Yes, that was my understanding, but I didn't see it, and it looked like it might be just 1 term. And I think in light of, on that, Mr. Chair, I think in light of the fact that the agents of the commission members themselves may have more history, if these public board members are confined to only a 4-year term, that the public history might be fairly limited, so it might be better if they were expanded. And on section 12D, I didn't know where the Water Resource Department got in here. Well, I know how it got in there, but I didn't know what our thinking was, and that's, I understand in the original 501392, perhaps, but, oh, no, it's not. It says information about the water, about line 21, information about the use of monies received by the Water Resource Department under section 4B, article 15 of the Constitution.
I think I'd like Jeanette Holman to come up, and could you help us out here, Jeanette?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Representative Jensen, that language is a carryover from the olden days when we were giving this to Water Resources Department. And this is a conceptual amendment, and in the final version, it's been taken out and it's changed to the board. We have actually processed these amendments through our publication services and now to the board.
That was kind of my of what I thought, but I wanted to clarify that. And once again, on section 15, in 1 and 2 of that, it still seems to me that the landowners, and I made this comment when we were talking about it before, but it still seems to me the landowners may be kind of left hanging out to dry on this. And I realize that we normally will seek action against the state, which typically has a bigger pool of money, but that might not make the landowners feel all that comfortable. And I don't exactly know. I leave that up to others with more knowledge than I have to
Any other? Did you have any more? Just any
general? That's my comment. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up on Representative Jensen's questions about the term limits of the board members. If the statute is silent, and this is a question for Jeanette, if the statute is silent on either term limits or reappointment, doesn't that leave the opportunity open for both reappointment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, that's correct, and I believe the custom has been to reappoint. The only limitation is that there's a 4-year limit on a term.
Representative Curtis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another follow-up on Representative Jensen when he was talking about the dual confirmation. I still prefer dual confirmation, and I understand the cumbersomeness of that, but I also feel that this is an important enough board that a little cumbersomeness I don't think is anything to make it shy away from doing it.
We're on 615. I just walked out of the room for a second. We're on section 15, or where are you at now? Because I don't want to.
We're just going through the bags so far.
Well, I'd like to take a second with section 15, too. Okay. My concern is how do we cap this money, or how do we control this fund we've created? I can see where a farmer or landowner could come in and start to run up one of these planes, and it could cost us millions of dollars. It would actually take away from the salmon restoration projects for the state of Oregon.
There too, on page 16, it says to the limits of the fund, so it would seem like whatever money was in there would be a finite amount of dollars, and then that would be the end of it.
Line are you on?
I'm on page 16, line 15.
Did you have a comment on that? You're looking like...
That is, I believe, the Attorney General's language, and I think that was the intent of that language, was to have some sort of limit on how much money could go for this. Now, there's nothing to say that the emergency board or the legislature couldn't give them more money if they needed it, but there would be a certain amount, a set amount.
What I would like to do is move over to the SAG-02, and stay right there. I think it might be helpful. Roy Hammond White, could you come up, please?
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hanger was sitting not quite at the front row, kind of midpoint in the row structure there. I'm going to assume he has some concerns.
Maybe I could sit right up there.
You could have a seat.
I understand, Mr. Chairman, that we're now going to talk about the -1002 amendments. And I have a paper here with what we list as the top seven problems with these amendments that I can distribute. And as we looked this over the weekend, we discovered one more that we want to mention. Before we get into those, with respect to what Representative Jensen said about capital expenditures in native salmonid populations, I just talked with Ken Beerley and asked him the question whether there are any native whether there are any salmonid species in Oregon which are not native to Oregon. And there are species which have been introduced into Oregon which are not native, which are sometimes a problem, such as brown trout. And so perhaps it would make sense to change that to both wild and native in the definition of capital expenditures, so that we are focusing on habitat for species which are native to Oregon, which are existing in the wild. With respect to the -1002, I want to make the following comments. First, we have noticed in the -5s and in other places that the definition of person who is eligible for grants has been changed. And we have asked the proponents on a number of occasions what motivates this change, and we've never gotten an answer. But yet it does exclude certain types of businesses from being eligible for grants. in this case, making partnerships ineligible for grants. And since many farms in particular are partnerships, we don't understand why the definition of person has been changed. There's some motivation here that we have been unable to discover. But the definition of person legally is broad. It includes all forms of business and corporations. And since we are trying to get the broadest group of people to be able to qualify for grants, we don't think that anybody should be excluded, and we didn't think there was anything wrong with the definition in the statute. Secondly,
Mr. Hemingway, your fix on that would be simply to change individual to person?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Could we ask Jeanette if that, from her point of view, has any impact on...
I think the question was if that had any impact on the meeting, right? I think you need to pull the mic over, Susan.
I was just curious if Jeanette could comment on if substituting person for individual in that situation would change the meaning of it at all.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, if person is removed and individual is created, what happens is you don't pick up the definition of person as it now appears in the statutes. And yes, it does change considerably who could be eligible.
So putting, putting person in there would open up the eligibility?
That's correct.
Okay.
Representative Morgan, are you saying that would be a problem? Open? Okay. Okay. Representative Cruz?
Yeah, well, I'm just wondering, if you have a problem with the removal of state and federal agencies at that point.
Representative Cruz, we have stated previously that we felt that state and federal agencies should be eligible for grants if they apply in cooperation with a watershed council or a soil and water conservation district.
But just to follow up, but the way it's stated here, that this the current language allows them to apply on their own.
That's correct. And we would agree to a compromise that would require them to apply in association with a soil and water conservation district or a watershed council.
I believe that's spoken to further down the document. Isn't that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, that is spoken to in the 04s. I'm not sure whether it is in the 1002s.
In the, excuse me, pardon me, Mr. Chair, members. It is in the, also in the 1002s, page 13, line 22.
Yes. Second, with respect to the definition of the term tribe, the way it's defined in the 1002s would make the only tribes eligible would be the tribes that are on the Umatilla and Warm Spring reservations, because those are the treaty tribes. Those are the ones which have treaties with the federal government. The other federally recognized tribes, which are primarily on the coast plus the Grand Ronde, are ones which would not qualify. Given in particular that the treaty tribes are ones which get quite a bit of funding through the Bonneville process, we think it's inappropriate that they be the only ones eligible for membership on the Watershed Enhancement Board.
I think there's common agreement on that issue, and yeah. More of a misprint.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Morgan?
Again, in that same clause, is it necessary to have the reference to off-reservation fishing rights in there at all? I'm on line 3 on page 3 of the 1002.
Senator, what I think maybe would be cleaner if we just allow Roy to go through his concerns, and then we'll go back and start through the
stuff. Okay. Yeah, thank you. Just so I fully understand, so what you're saying is if our definition of tribe is just federally recognized tribes.
And that's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, third, under the 1002, the Soil and Water Conservation District and Watershed Councils are required to share technical staff. In many cases, this is beneficial and it's going on, and we have no problem with being urged to do so. Elsewhere, it's unrealistic because they're not even in the same town. So we would prefer that language be deleted. Number four,
Chairman?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Henry, isn't that permissive language rather than requires? It does say shall. I grant you that, but it says to the maximum extent practicable. Okay. Yes. It seemed to me that that was kind of a permissive thought rather than a mandate to distant offices to try and share staff.
Mr. Chair, I've always thought shall meant shall, and we would prefer it to be more permissive than that.
Could it be, would may help, or you asked for the whole
country? Well, may would help, yes. That would certainly be permissible. Now, our number four is probably the most important, which is a point we have made repeatedly throughout these discussions. And that is that we believe that the Watershed Enhancement Board should be, at least for this biennium, a grant-making entity only. We have a good deal more work for this body to do to get up and running and to make grants and to give them responsibilities to review strategic plans of agencies and to develop budget recommendations and other things which are facilitation and oversight responsibilities for the plan. We believe it's a recipe for chaos rather than a recipe for a smoothly operating Oregon plan. If there is one thing I heard during the interim from the predecessor to this committee, it was that there was a strong feeling that there was duplication and not enough coordination within the Oregon plan. And the governor made a change in putting me in this position in order to try to avoid those problems. What this amendment does is give another agency, an independent agency, some responsibilities, a little vague, but some responsibilities to conduct coordination and oversight and facilitation functions for the Oregon plan. This entity would have no authority to make any of that happen. It's simply one among equals of state agencies. And having been at the table with many state agencies, I can tell you what happens when you have one among equals trying to help others get them to do what that one agency wants, which is not much. The governor's office under our system of government, which is generally a weak executive system, has the best chance of bringing about coordination and avoiding duplication. And it has been the governor's strong feeling that the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, while being an independent state agency, which you've created here, should not have oversight and facilitation functions, and that when we discuss how we can provide stronger coordination, it's a longer-term discussion involving the authorities of all the agencies which are engaged in the Oregon plan. The Oregon plan goes beyond the watershed grant function. There are elements of the Oregon plan in probably at least half a dozen major state agencies and probably several more beyond that. And how an independent 17-member board is supposed to act to help facilitate and oversee those functions of other state agencies, we simply don't understand how that's to happen. This is a critical difference of opinion between us and the 1002 amendments, and I can't help but point it out.
Section 10, is that a, you mentioned here, 7 and 12. You're trying to further identify exactly what.
All right, I will. The Section 12 is the primary problem here.
The question is Section 10 a problem?
If the, as long as the duties and responsibilities of the board are grant-making only, we don't have a problem with Section 10. If in Section 10 there are additional duties to the board, then we do have a problem with expecting this director to enter into interagency agreements. The in Section 12, there is a requirement that the Watershed Enhancement Board establish a framework for locally based integrated watershed planning and management. And then in B, which is probably the most difficult for us, the board is expected to review strategic plans and rules of each state agency to coordinate Salmonid watershed and habitat restoration plans and their implementation. That is a job which currently is in the governor's office to try to get these state agencies to coordinate. And we don't believe that a grant-making board should have that authority, particularly because it doesn't have any ability to carry it out.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm sensitive to Mr. Hanway's concerns, and I read this section and I read these sections a little bit differently, and I guess my focus is the Watershed Council and Saltwater Conservation functions and the actual planning and development of on-the-ground type activities rather than a focus upward at other state agencies. My focus in reading this was at the basin level, at the watershed level, at the project level. So when I read, for instance, in Section 12, 1A, it wasn't just establish a framework, which looks like a really broad mandate for the committee. It was establish a framework for locally based integrated watershed planning and management. So the framework is for the watershed planning, which is a fairly narrow focus on what the framework will do. And it's basically designed to build this framework to assist the councils in the watershed conservation districts to do something, and that is to work within the state and federal laws without duplication. So again, instead of seeing the framework being something that would be imposed on all state agencies across a broad landscape, the framework is pointed at water conservation districts and watershed councils to help them develop a management process for integrating watershed planning and management. So as I went through that section, I read the same language, and we worked hard to make that all of this rather permissive than more structurally demanding and permissiveness. And I guess I saw a much tighter focus. But
Mr. Co-Chair, subsection A is not as difficult for us, doesn't present as many difficulties as other subsections. But I want to point out that everything we do in the Oregon plan is watershed-based. That is the level of our attention. And so our efforts to create locally based watershed efforts take place at every level and in every agency involved in the Oregon plan.
Hemingway, I would concur that we need to be very careful that we don't give responsibility that we don't have authority.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my problem here is that what it sounds to me, if I boil this all down, is that the governor's office is willing to create this independent body here as long as all of the authorities are left in the governor's office. Is that basically it?
Representative Cruz, right now there is no authority in any state agency to command the attention of another state agency. We don't have authority to order most of the natural resource agencies to do anything under our system because they are commissions which hire their own directors and operate under their own statutes. What we try to do is use what force of authority the governor's office has, which is primarily what in legal terms we call precatory, which means just to try to use our force of moral authority to coordinate and make them do what we think is the right thing in the watersheds and to make them work together. Our very strong feeling is that one agency among equals can't play that role. I was here in the 1970s when we tried to get LCDC to play that role, and it was a devil of a time.
This was crafted specifically not to give this new entity command and control over any state agencies, because we don't want that. And I guess, it just baffles me to think that we have to compel our natural resource agencies to cooperate to try to do the best things for watersheds. That is their function. And what we're creating here is just a place to coordinate information and coordinate activities, make sure that everybody knows what everybody else is doing. I would think that by now everybody would know in all the agencies that that's what the mission is supposed to be.
Leonard, and I think I want to keep moving on through Roy's. Senator Leonard.
Thank you. I think we want to get to the same place, but I am frankly a little concerned that some decisions, specifically as it relates to a project I've been involved with at Ross Island, has actually caused state agencies who wanted to do the right thing to back off. How can we get to the point where we have oversight of the Oregon plan where those of us that want to do the right thing don't have to worry that with some effective lobbying techniques, state agencies are actually given the message to not do. Actually, I think just the opposite of what your point is. I think your point is that you can compel them through moral force to do the right thing. In this instance, it would appear to me that they're compelled to do not the right thing for economic reasons. And what I'm grappling with is trying to be able to support a structure that will, to the extent possible, minimize political influence on decisions that are made in implementing the Oregon plan. So that's a broad question.
but frankly, that example has concerned me enough that I'm becoming a little leery of just precisely where the implementation of the Oregon Plan should be managed from.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leonard, I'm glad you brought that up if you were concerned about it. You're referring specifically to the Ross Island situation, and I want to make clear that what was reported in the press, at least the implication that was made in the press, was incorrect. No one in the governor's office made any suggestion to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife about how that situation should be handled. No one. And I want to make that absolutely clear. The only communication that occurred there was my telling Jim Greer that the lobbyist for Ross Island might call him, which he did not do.
I think it's yours, Mr. Chairman.
And that situation, and I think if you ask the people who in the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife on what basis they made their decision, they would also echo they made that decision on legal and biological grounds and on no other. They did not make it on the assumption that the governor's office wanted a result. Had I investigated that situation and communicated anything to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, I might have asked for a different result. But we asked for no result.
Let me break in here. I don't know that we need to get into the details of Ross Island. I think the point, Representative Leonard, is, as I see it at least, is that each of these boards and commissions has their own set of rules and regulations. In Oregon, we have no, the governor can't even have oversight over those agencies. And I think that's the crux. There's been a lot of us been concerned about that for some time. But I believe that the way you can alter that is to go back through every board and agency, which is going to be a huge job. And I think it's been tried many times over the years by different governors and have not been able to do that. That is a very political issue, and that is the problem, that no one has oversight authority.
But I think that the point I'm trying to get at, and it's not real clear in my mind, so it probably comes out a little fuzzy, the point I'm trying to get at is if we want to have an entity that oversees the Oregon Plan, don't we want to be assured that to the extent possible, right decisions are made absent of some political influence? And I guess what I'm trying to come to grips with for myself, and maybe already everybody else already has, is what is the best mechanism for that to occur. And I just used, I'm not intending to want to get into depth into the issue at Ross Island, but as some of you are aware, I've been dealing with some of the issues there this session. And I just, it concerns me that we don't have a system in place that would, if the governor's office, in fact, would like a different decision made than what happened there, but that happened. If that's the problem, that we need to have some more direct control over ODF&W, for example, then that's what I'm interested in looking at, is how do we do that? But something happened that would appear to have been different than what some of the biologists at ODF&W wanted to happen, and isn't that precisely the issue that we're dealing with here? How do we make decisions that are going to best enhance salmon restoration habitat? And if something is happening in our political system to not allow that to happen, that's what I want to talk about and figure out how to fix. And if Section 12 does that, I'm more inclined to support it. If it doesn't, why not?
I really appreciate Representative Leonard trying to frame that question, because it brings a little of the commentary that Ms. Shannon was making. The focus for me
I understand the frustration of the governor's office in not being able to have direct control of some of the agencies, some more than others, depending on how the executive directors are appointed and whether the executive director answers to an elected board or an appointed board or answers directly to the governor. The attempt in this session is to create a citizen board. And we wanted to be very cognizant of the prerogatives of the executive and not overreach those. And I can see that in, for instance, on page 12, where, you know, on line 12, it talks about review strategic plans and rules of each state agency to coordinate. That may be an overreaching. And similarly, in C section on line 15, line 17, adopt state priorities based on measurable goals. Maybe that, in fact, should be a synthesis rather than an adoption or some kind of a relative recapitulation of the state priorities rather than giving this agency that role. But I can see in Representative Leonard's discussion the wisdom of adding the moral suasion of the citizen board, because in fact it's the landowner's fear that the biologists at ODFW or the politicians that or the lobbyists or the other stakeholders who are very well facilitated in this process end up pulling this thing in one direction or another. And we're trying, I think, to put this a little bit beyond the direct influences of any one group, but rather to make a synthesis of the influences of many groups. So I think in this regard, the thing that got me focused was Representative Leonard's comment that I think we're trying to get to the same place. I think we are trying to get to the same place. That's not to usurp the prerogatives of the executive, but rather to create a mechanism by which citizens, and if you look at every one of the appointees on this board, the voting members are all citizens from boards and commissions or all directly appointed citizens. And that, to me, is the mechanism that gives people a better assurance that this will be broadly representative of Oregonians' desires at every different level, rather than focusing it either in the governor's office or the legislature. So I can see that there are sections in here where language might be uncomfortable, but I think the thrust of this whole section is to create a better place where information is coordinated, where it's communicated to the watershed councils, where there is a place for review and comment by citizens and landowners and other stakeholders. That gets synthesized by a broad group. Not necessarily that they would order or compel agencies to follow a checklist. Those oversight roles are shared statutorily between the appropriate legislative oversight committee and the executive branch. And we have kind of a dual role there. So I would like to see some specific language changes that move us toward a better comfort level from the governor's office, but to understand that it isn't necessarily the desire of the committee to create a single board that has executive authority over any other boards and commissions, but there is a need to coordinate, communicate, synthesize, put into perspective even the ranking and prioritization of the grant application, I think, are the things that the board
likes to do. Where would you like to go on?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. 5, 6, and 7 are fairly technical points regarding language, and I don't think I need to comment on them. I just wanted to point out one more thing, which is in 12B2 on page 13, lines 25 to 27, OWEB is asked to submit a general fund budget request to the Legislative Assembly, bypassing the governor's normal budget process, and that's quite an unprecedented direction to a state agency.
So, should the budget process?
Yes, I mean, they're certainly entitled to submit a general fund budget request through the general executive budget process like any other agency, but to allow them to make that directly is irregular.
What was that, Mr. Chair? What page?
On page 13, 25 through 27.
Mr. Hanaway brings up an excellent point, and I guess when we discussed that issue, it was that that's an attempt to deal with the definition of the word limitation more than it is an attempt to restructure the functions and the prerogatives of the executive branch. As a matter of fact, it never occurred to me, at least, that this was a outside the normal processes. The idea was that at some point in time, general fund budget requests and limitations have to be built into the process. And I suppose on reflection, of course, that comes from the governor's office, as all those budgets do. But I think the impulse was simply to make sure that it was clearly stated that there was a budget request made. And, you know, obviously it does come before the Legislative Assembly at some point, but it wasn't an attempt, in my opinion, to bypass the governor's office.
I think we can fix that.
Before I start doing the explanation, I would like to use the explanation of the explanation
of the explanation of the tried to take what we agreed to in the room, with the exception of the Treaty Tribe, and put the Heritage Program back in.
Federal recognized tribe. Would you like to speak to the Heritage Program?
Not this time. I want to go ahead and get through these, since I never have seen these. They didn't get to my office. And when we left, I didn't know there was going to be two versions. I thought there was only going to be one version. Break down the communications here. And so...
Let's go back on the section 1002.
Mr. Chairman, line 19, page 1. I think the committee's going to have to deal with the word wild or native or wild or wild and high and wild or. And the idea is that if wild salmonid populations key to wild fish policies, then there's, I think, a problem. If we look at native only, then any wildlife habitat management for introduced species would be ineligible for funding. And I know the Department of Fish and Wildlife has been managing for introduced species right along native species. And I don't know if you could make a distinction when you're talking about something. I'll use a different example since habitat is terrestrial and aquatic. What do we do in a case where somebody wants to do some management on habitat and this could probably be occupied by Rio Grande turkey? So the point is it would be ineligible for any funding under the Oregon plan if it's native species only, or bass management in the those are not restorations of native species. In fact, those are habitat improvements to non-native species. And when we look at wildlife habitat as a function of Measure 66, it's not clear from the initiative whether or not we're limiting ourselves to only native species, in my opinion. So
there
thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. That would be my suggestion. With both wild and native, we're dealing with adjectives that are still in flux with the definition, and we're supposed to be dealing with salmonid, so why don't we just say salmonid and let it go at that.
Mr. Chair, I have a question before we go any further. As to exactly
what our expectations are here. The last time we met, my understanding was that we had reached consensus, and today we were going to bring those consensus amendments, which I understand are the dash 4 back, and ratify those, and 3225 would be together, and we would move on. It was a surprise to me to see the dash 1002s on Friday, bringing in issues we had not reached consensus on, that had not been worked out in public discussion, and that were old issues that I thought we were past. So I'm concerned at this point, since my understanding is tomorrow is our absolute drop-dead deadline to put out a bill, exactly what the chair's expectations are at this point.
Before you arrived, at least that I mentioned that. What the dash 04s are,
is it your expectation to reach consensus on the 1002s this morning?
No. We're simply not going to have time, but that's not new yet.
Okay, and I just want to express my concerns about that. I took my weekend and I looked through these, but I have to say that with the difference of opinion over interpretation and that sort of thing, I'm not comfortable that I understand the full impacts of what's in the 1002s, and I'm not sure, given everybody's workload today and tomorrow, that by 4:30 tomorrow I will feel comfortable with people's interpretation of what this word means or that word means, and I guess I would express some of agree with what some of Representative Thompson's concerns, that this is a lot of substantive stuff at the last minute, and I want to know that when I vote this out, that I actually understand what it is we're creating. So I'm concerned with where we're going. Fine. Can we expect to see another set of new amendments? I mean, that's part of my frustration level. I thought we had reached tentative agreement twice, once with the governor's office and once in the committee, and we're still moving off of that and moving onward. So I keep hoping that at some point consensus means just that, and we can say yes. And I'm hoping it's sooner rather than later.
Our committee rules allow for any member of the committee to bring forth amendments.
Absolutely, but when the co-chairs choose to work behind the scenes and bring out a full new set of amendments, it is frustrating.
I think the co-chairs are simply trying to bring the scene.
Chair?
Yes.
My frustration is very high because I didn't have the advantage of the weekend to look at this. And this is a lot of material, and maybe I read slower and not a lawyer. I'm a fisherman, but it takes time for me to function. And here we are down at the end of a 3.5-month committee. And in defense of the co-chairs, when you have a 14-person committee, it's a lot more difficult. I question when we put 14 people on here because of the communication problems in this time, I guess. And I'm sure inadvertently left out in the cold. But here we are at the last day, and in the process, we normally have amendments to fix to a bill. And I'm not sure that if I sat down tonight and worked all night that I could get Jeanette, who's been stressed beyond any belief of anyone I've ever seen in this process, to try to get an amendment forward to correct anything that I did find in here. And that worries me after 3.5 months.
that we're in that situation. And I don't think it was intentional, but like I say, my frustration level is high because of that.
Is there anyone else on the committee besides Eric Thompson who did not receive the chair?
And probably part of the reason, if it was mailed to me, is that you're not familiar to our section of the coast. It seems to be 1 to 2 days longer to Newport than anywhere else.
If that wasn't possible to try other means to deliver, and I think we accomplished that with 14 members out of 14 members.
Yes, and I'd like to clarify that as I went through the National Constitution, this is not a co-chair's proposal. I went through some sections and just sent them marked out. It's an opportunity for us to look at everything that's going on.
And Mr. Chairman, I think there's another. I don't think the committee has come to closure on whether you do nothing. You just create the absolute mandate from the Measure 66. Whether we move OLEB out of the government or GLEB out into OLEB and create a broader base and more serviceable entity. And I think that's been the discussion and the thrust of the discussion for months. So I guess I'm not hearing any new concepts here. I'm hearing the mechanisms and seeing the mechanisms on paper that would accomplish that. And I'm also hoping people are hearing a willingness to adjust wherever that line is. You don't want to create a disconnect between the branches, but we want to make a serviceable tool. I think it's clear that this committee retains oversight authority because it's been so in the legislative branch. There's no intent to take management authority away from the executive branch, but there needs to be some mechanism that coordinates activities and shares information and does some basic descriptors across a wide variety of not always state agencies. Sometimes it's non-governmental, sometimes it's private entities, some it is state agencies. And so this statute or 1002 is an attempt to synthesize much of that concept. And I don't expect everybody in the community to agree, and as a matter of fact, we may end up not agreeing. But the we built on a series of steps to get here. It isn't a matter of all the steps just coming, somehow arriving at the committee without any discussion. I think every one of us has heard every one of these concepts almost to the point of nausea, ad nauseam. So I appreciate Senator Drew's comments, but I don't think this has just been dropped at the table without lots and lots of conceptual discussion to this point.
Senator, I think we've got about 17 minutes left.
We need to make all the hay we can. If any of you can. Yeah, I'd like to express a little optimism that I think we have come pretty close on a lot of things. I think we still have a substantive area in terms of whether we have an issue that can be compartmentalized in an agency and have a budget accordingly, or whether we still need to be using the governor's authority because we're having to cross so many dimensions. But I'm optimistic that we can come to a good place within our next meeting. I'm not so quote, overwhelmed by the amount of material that I find here. Representative Thompson and I had gone to legislative council and had requested -12 amendments to be drawn, and we received them this morning at the same time everyone else did, in part. I didn't know very much about the natural heritage, and that was something we probably wanted to, that information system we probably wanted to bring back into the
into the function, and also to try and address what we thought was, you know, close to consensus on Friday. We knew that there was an existence of the 1,002s that, in terms of the substance, you know, didn't get that until later. But I do think we are narrowing down, you know, in terms of, you know, what we either, you know, can come to consensus on or what we end up having to disagree on.
Anybody want to express any outrage about the Dash 12 amendments that nobody else commented this morning?
Okay, you're at the same level I am with the other two.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't have a problem with it. We figure out, you know, it moves the heritage concept back onto the table. It's not, anyway.
I'd like to make the best use we can of the time we have left. Several areas in the Dash 12
where are you at?
Well, in one example on page 4, 25-29, on page 5, lines 23-25, very exploded tribes as well as tribes that are
back to the top of page 4, the first line was
stewardship includes it all over.
Yes, it does.
Does anyone have any? Yep,
through page 5.
In the definitions on page 2, the definition of riparian area, did that come to us from as a chunk from some other place, or did we formulate that one ourselves?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, riparian area is existing statutory language, so it's what's in the statutes now.
My next comment.
I really wondered if we didn't want a statement, as one of the statements in there, watershed in Oregon is unique, and each requires different management techniques and programs. That recognition of that each watershed is unique.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, the members are asking for a page reference and
Section 4, line
23.
And we have the policy of the state of Oregon that the voluntary program, the state agency, is accepted. And this is the one that you
Mr. Chair?
Yes. finish there.
I think that the language is about a part of the cylinder that you're doing the assembly on.
Let's move on. I'm on page 6, section 6, the top. And we've already had a discussion with Mr. Hemingway about the penalty. Find a better word. That's line 7.
Isn't that where you had the concern, George?
Yes, that's one area.
Mr. Chair, I'm reading Roy's paper here, and he has some suggested language that says, shall use its grant-making authorities to facilitate.
To watershed representation, I think we need to have it defined.
Page 7,
line 31.
Mm-hmm.
What region are you in methods? I'm not sure it needs to be sure with watershed.
Gesturing wildly at you.
Well, not wildly.
Mr. Chair, that language is straight out of the Constitution. You can still
add to it,
or further define it, but that language is what's in the Constitution.
That I've found that I wanted to discuss is on page 14, line 7 and line 27, talking about who can request grants. The requester may submit a request to the board. I think that's wrong, because if we allow people to implement the process and move the process and pull, we can't believe we had that happen. Grant process, big work, and the process wasn't fine. Suddenly, the applicants are going straight to the board and the thing over. So, I think it's absolutely important that whoever makes an application goes through the process and then open the door. That's a close deal.
Sharon, can I regress the page number?
Well, I want to make sure we get a consensus.
Yeah. I agree.
I think that we need to have everybody going through the same process, and that if the grants have to go through either the Soil and Water Conservation Districts or the Watershed Council before they get to the board, and all the grants go through the same route, that we'll be well served in the long run.
Okay.
Thank you. Just a question. Are there areas of the state where there wouldn't be a local watershed council? Well, I guess that's how you get around. I'm just questioning. That's all I'm asking.
I think either or.
Yeah, because I agree with the process, but I don't want to lock somebody out.
The entire state's covered by one or both.
Mr. Chair, is there any difficulty? We've been told that there are some areas where the watershed councils and the soil and water conservation districts are not working hand in glove together. I'm assuming that where you have board, that's going to change to watershed council under what you're talking about. So are we giving the opportunity for where both exist for some applications to go to one and some applications to go to the other? And can that potentially, in those areas where they're not working well together, set up a conflict?
I don't think we're recording, Senator, for both. And I think what you just stated is exactly what is that. From the watershed, they can get an application out of the
I guess my concern was if the two entities are not working well together, then a proposal that might not have been encouraged by one could be encouraged by the other. And it seems as though that could lead to more discord than cooperation.
So what would be the...
I'd actually, if we have to have both, I mean, I like the system the way it is, understand, and I think running them through the watershed councils that we created for doing this sort of thing is the best way to do it. But if we need to do both, I would rather that somehow...
Does or.
Well, and that's my concern, that some folks will choose to go to one and some people will choose to go to the other, and those two, and in those areas where they're not now working together, we may be allowing more divisiveness than cooperation. I just remember that one wonderful Saturday, a testimony about how they don't all get along so well. And it would be nice. I mean, in the past, the watershed councils pretty much worked with the applicants and things and gotten it all started.
We also have different types of projects and applications.
That would be nice.
I think the language in the draft that talks about to the maximum extent practicable, these agencies and organizations should work together. And we have to remember, Soil Water Conservation Districts are a state agency. And watershed councils are sometimes sanctioned by the county government, and sometimes they are not. So they are not. I don't think you can put the watershed councils on a preeminent position as a Soil Water Conservation District. Vice versa, I think they have to work together where they can. But I wouldn't think that you'd want to... direct the traffic all one direction or another. I don't think you can do that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this language about the requester may submit a request to the board or to a local soil and water conservation district goes back to the creation of the first Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board in 1987. At that time, they allowed the soil and water conservation districts, or the idea was to allow them to make directly to anybody who applied small grants of a certain amount without having to go all the way to the board. That's never happened. I don't believe it's ever worked. The language of giving it to the board allows them to process grants. I mean, I guess I see a practical problem in if I as an individual want to submit a grant, which watershed council do I give it to? But a watershed council, I mean, the generic board is the recipient of the application, and they can direct them to be administered or collected at a local soil and water conservation district. They can collect them on a regional level, which is, I think, what they do now. But that distinction here goes back to that 1987 small grant process that was set up for the soil and water conservation districts.
Good Chairman, on page 9, and maybe in lots of the books, the dismissal on line 24 is for cause. Yeah, was there a section that was holding up? That was an issue of concern to some people.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, We didn't address that category in this set of amendments, or in any of them at this point, because I was unclear as to how you wanted to, you know, do you want them to not be able to hold over for a certain period of time? You know, I guess I was unclear on the direction, so I didn't do anything at this point.
And that answers my question, Mr. Chairman. We just haven't dealt with it in this draft.
We'll meet again tomorrow at 4:30.
Yay!